Okay, so there's many studies. We've all gone out, we've measured nitrous oxide emissions, and sometimes we'll be looking at, what emissions do we get for a certain management practice. But as often happens, you do it over here, you do it over there, you don't necessarily get the same results. And it's affected by your soil properties, your climatic conditions, and so on. And so we really do need to come to, I think, a little bit better understanding as what's really driving these processes in some of the cases. And part of the difficulty we have is that we tend to know a bit about the factors one at a time. And I'm going to be talking really in the context of denitrification. We're from a more of a humid climate. It's mostly about denitrification. So here's a number of different factors, and we really know fairly well what each factor does to nitrous oxide emissions. We know what it does to the N2 molar ratio, that is how much of the gaseous loss comes off as nitrous oxide. The difficulty, though, is when you go to the field, is when you get in the field, what's the relative importance of these factors? Now, I wanted to go and spend a little bit of time on this. It explains a bit why we went the way we did. So, classic approach would be you take your data and then you do a regression, right? So you're going to relate different factors to your emissions. And I pulled out this, and obviously I picked the extremes to make the point. So this is data from a trial we had. I picked three different sampling dates, and we have a soil nitrate concentration against the nitrous oxide flux measured on a given date. And you can see you've got everything, right? So you've got the days, you've got lots of nitrate, but no flux. You got days with not much nitrate, and you get lots of flux, and you have everything in between. And so you look at that, and you think, okay, well, that's a bit of a challenge. And the first thought is, well, obviously there's just something else that's a factor here, right? Something else that's not involved in the regression. But in fact, it looks like there's something a little bit more than that. And I want to take the next two slides to explain what part of what I think is going on. So this is from a very simple trial. It was done with barley. We had three fertilizer N rates. On the right, I have the soil nitrate concentration, and on the left, the nitrous oxide flux. And so we put the fertilizer on here. You can see you have this nice response in nitrate, decreasing over time as the crop takes the nitrogen up. Look at the nitrous oxide flux, and pretty much follows the same pattern. So this is what we normally expect. Here's the next year, okay? So here we have the same pattern of soil nitrate. In the spring, there's no flux. So flux is not occurring necessarily when the nitrate's there. But you get to later in the fall, and you have now a nitrous oxide flux where you don't have much nitrate. And sure enough, it's responding to the nitrogen rate. So what's going on? Well, our interpretation here is that nitrate that we have early in the season, it was a dry year, so we didn't have the nitrification, we didn't get the flux, but this is changing our plant growth. And we went through a dry period, went through a rewetting, released carbon, we had a flush of microbial activity, and this nitrogen at this time gave us higher carbon availability at this time. So not only do we have different factors coming into it, but we also have different time scales. So we can have an effective nitrate at a different time, in this case up to months later. And so that makes the classic regression approach difficult. So this is something that Dave Burton and I were working on is, well, can we come up with a time-integrated measure now? Is there some way of taking time into account? So we've come up with this thing, we call it nitrate exposure. You may have heard nitrate intensity. We changed the name. What can I say? So anyways, now what we have is a time-integrated measure. So we're taking, similar to a degree day, we're basically taking your soil nitrate concentration each day and adding it up over the growing season. And so you get a single value for the growing season. So we have now here the cumulative flux over the growing season, we have the nitrate exposure, and you get a nice linear relationship. So this is the 2 years that I showed you, that we had a third year. So it doesn't necessarily tell you the absolute amount, right, because your years are different, but it does give you then a nice, relatively linear response. So nitrate exposure is giving you a good sense of the risk associated with it. So what we wanted to do then is, well, let's go in the field and let's see. So what really are the factors that are most important? And we looked at three. So the nitrate using nitrate exposure, we'll look at carbon availability, and for that we use the cumulative growing season carbon dioxide flux. And for aeration, for lack of a better idea, because we didn't have a good idea, we came up with just the average water fill pore space. And this is data from two different experiments, and we just kind of pool the data together, but they'll run like side by side in the same fields in the same year. So we're integrating the data. So we wanted to compare different things. So all the emissions I'm going to talk about are from the potato crop, but they were from seven different two-year potato rotations. So these are all the different preceding crops. So this was to get differences in carbon and nitrogen availability. We also compared different row locations, so in the ridge, in the furrow, and furrows that had been compacted. And in our case, we're banning the fertilizer into the ridge. And then for just selected treatments, rotation treatments, we had different nitrogen managements. So basically looking at all this together. So first I want to look at the situation where we have the same cropping system, but we're just changing the nitrogen management. So again, this is all emissions from potato and all where barley was the preceding crop. So again, we have our cumulative nitrous oxide emissions as a function of the nitrate exposure. So this is 2008. We have a pretty nice relationship. We're explaining, you know, 80% or so of the variability in the emissions. Look at 2009, get the same thing, pretty good relationship. And this seems to be pretty consistent with the data that we have. So in the same cropping system, it seems to be really all about the nitrate. That really explains the variability. So now let's compare different cropping systems. So I start off here with just simple correlation. So looking at the cumulative emissions for the growing season and comparing them against the nitrate exposure. So yes, nice relationship. But now there's also a nice relationship to carbon. Now, this is not significant, and in fact, this here I think is mostly an artifact. I think what we're really getting here is the fact that because we've banded the fertilizer in the ridge, the nitrate and the water are changing simultaneously. Now, so we go back, we do the same kind of graph we did before, so this cumulative nitrous oxide against nitrate exposure. Now, as it turns out, for five of those preceding seven crops, we get the same thing. We get this nice linear relationship. We're explaining a lot of the variability in nitrous oxide, but we have two that are different. And these are our two forages. So we have a red clover, so legume forage, Italian ryegrass, which is a non-legume forage. And they're strikingly different. And this we attribute to carbon. So in those two rotations, first thing in the spring, the first few dates, we had much higher respiration and higher nitrous oxide emissions. So we went the next step then and said, okay, well, let's try the multiple regression. So now we have a relationship. So nitrate exposure, we're looking at the carbon availability and the water-filled pore space. Still lots of noise, but not bad. So by taking into account the different factors, quite a bit better prediction of the nitrous oxide emissions. So I guess to conclude, so again, remembering we're in a humid environment, and this is really in the context of denitrification. So within a given cropping system, it really does seem to be all about nitrate. So we in the past, for mitigation, we've really focused on nitrogen management. And so in that scenario, that makes sense. What it does say, though, is that when you start to go across cropping systems, then you do have to be cautious. It isn't necessarily about nitrate. It might be, might not. So depending on the cropping system, the carbon can be as or perhaps even more important than the nitrate in controlling the amount of emissions that you have. And so if you want to do effective mitigation, you really have to manage both nitrate and carbon. And we found the nitrate exposure was quite effective as a time-integrated measure. It gave us a pretty reliable measure of the relative risk. Not absolute, but relative risk. And I think the reason it's fairly effective is because it's picking up both direct and indirect effects. So you get the direct effects as a terminal electron acceptor, and then you get indirect effects through other factors such as, for example, carbon availability. Thank you.
We have the time for several questions. With the nitrate, the accumulated nitrate correlates to N2 very well. What is the mechanism behind that? Is it nitrate being assimilated into micro biomass? How nitrate was not there, and then in the early stage, in a few months earlier, and then N2 suddenly become emitted a few months later. So where is the nitrate stored?
Well, I can speculate, right, because I don't have the answer. But my guess is that what happens is with the higher nitrogen rate, so the zero N was actually quite deficient in this particular case. So I'm running a system that's purposely is going to be responsive. So at the zero N rate, it's quite limited. So I'm getting limited crop growth. So with the higher N rate, I'm getting a lot more biomass produced above and below ground, right? And I'm also getting a lower CN ratio of that biomass. And you're suggesting maybe different microbial biomass, perhaps that as well, right? So you have all these different things that are all changing the system. And what happened is in the three years, in two of the 3 years, we had a big flush of nitrous oxide late in the season. And those are the 2 years where we had significant drying. So we had a drying cycle, we had a re-wetting cycle. The re-wetting cycle then gave us the release of a lot of that carbon. And in that case, then, because of the higher N availability, the nature of that carbon was different. Yeah. Oh, sorry.
I understand you're looking into the denitrification and nitrous oxide. And you use up the average water vapor space under those conditions probably doesn't seem to justify it.
It's actually a pretty poor measure, yes. Now, the unfortunate thing is the other parameters we had measured basically every sampling date, that we didn't really have the same intensity of sampling. I did a bit of a search through literature to look for a good index, and I didn't find one. So if anybody has one, I'd love to see it, because I'm not really sure. I mean, we toyed with things like, you know, what percentage of time are you above 70% water fill pore space or something, but we didn't really have a good one. And unfortunately, in this case, we did have some variation, but not as strong as you might. Like we have another thing I didn't show today where we did the emissions in the rotation year, the rotation crop year. So we have there quite a bit more variation in the water fill pore space. And there it's much more important. But you're right. I mean, that was not the best measure.
Did you try looking at the days after rainfall event?
We're in an environment, we get a lot of rainfall events, and you know, we get some small ones, some big ones. It's a little tricky to do that. Yeah, I think water fill pore space is probably the best way to do it. It's just a question of getting a good data set. Yeah.
So you showed one graph with a lot of N2O but no nitrate. Mm-hmm. And you had an explanation, kind of, sort of, I guess. So do you think there's either mineralization going on there, or could there be nitrify or N2O?
Well, I think you don't necessarily need much nitrate, right? So, and I mean, it does get complicated because of the spatial location and so on. So what we're finding is, as long as you have, particularly in the Potato Ridge, where it's very fluffy, we're finding virtually all of the denitrification is giving N2O, because we think it diffuses away before it has a chance to go to completion. So it really doesn't take much. These are small amounts. And so, you know, I think that's mostly what's going on.
Just one comment on that. Usually you will find that there's an optimum value of nitrate beyond which it will not have any effect on nitrogen emissions at all. Mm-hmm. Because under denitrification, the bug's capacity to do that, you run out of that. So it's more related to
Yes, in fact, what we find is, we also measure denitrification rate. And so the nitrate, in our case, rarely affects identification rate. Usually what's changing is the N2O molar ratio. So we're just getting more coming off as N2O. Yeah. Was on the back? It was simultaneously with measuring the N2O. We used the static chamber. So we measured N2O and CO2 simultaneously, and then we made sure there was no plants inside the chamber itself. Yeah.
So just doing the days use?
We did our measurement. It was about weekly, and we had a 30-minute deployment. Yeah.
Any more questions?
Could you comment on kind of the, I apologize up front for saying this is like a policy type question.
Yeah.
Trying to intersect the science.
We
know how hard that is. Yeah. But If policy were to come, at least for the states here, on the basis of some kind of generalized estimate for nitrous oxide emissions, is there enough data to come up with a policy like that, would you say, that would be substantial enough and defensible?
Well.
And you are being recorded. Are there lawyers?
I think we talk in general about what's the most effective strategy, right? So the most effective strategy is what we always talk about, right? You want to match the supply of nitrogen to the demand of nitrogen, okay? And as usual, the big problem we have is that the supply and the demand both vary largely and unpredictably. But we find, and other people find, that as you get above that optimum, the amount of emission per unit in addition goes up very rapidly, okay? So the best thing is to try and get any excess fertilization removed and get back down to that optimal. So this is why we spend all this time obsessing about trying to figure out what an optimal N rate is. Part of the reason we started looking at this was, well, because it's so much work to measure nitrous oxide, can we measure something else? So for example, can we measure nitrate exposure? So can we start running trials and say, okay, well, I'm going to change my timing, I'm going to change my fertilizer source, I'm going to change whatever, and see what it does to nitrate exposure without having to go measure nitrous oxide all the time. So then we could maybe fast track, if you will. But, I mean, from a pragmatic point of view, I mean, reducing over-fertilization is really the most practical. Yeah, and it does get complicated. I mean, I talked about carbon, but then there's also water, right? So depending on where you are, well, in drainage systems and also soil quality, right? Give you an internal structure, which has to do with aeration. But all of these things are very complicated, right? Because as you get wetter, you get more denitrification. If you get really, really wet, then it goes to completion and you get N2 instead of N2O. So it's reducing excess. That's the key.
That's the policy.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Okay.